Hi, this is Nick Gillespie with The Reason Podcast. We're doing a talk show format today, and with me are Catherine Mangu Ward. She is the new editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine, and Eli Lake, a national security reporter for Bloomberg View. Catherine, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
And Eli, thank you for joining us.
Great to be here.
So let's talk about Trump and the allegations of abuse or of sexual assault and whatnot. Catherine, you're a woman. That is the, you know, at least that's the rumor. What is, I mean, like, if these things are true, does that disqualify Trump from being president? Or do we not even have to get there because he may not be qualified to be president in the first place?
I mean, apparently it doesn't in the eyes of a pretty significant number of women who say they're still voting for him. I think it's like we're testing the proposition that the candidates themselves don't matter, that the only thing that matters is their party affiliation.
Right.
Like we're offering people up two totally garbage candidates and then saying, okay, what if we made it worse? What if we made it worse? And still, there's just a hardcore group of people that are like, does he have an R next to his name? I'm in. And
yeah.
I think, you know, that certainly gives me cause to be totally cynical about the political process.
Now, you're a famous non-voter, so you're not going to, I mean, it in a way, it doesn't affect your choice. But is there a limit, or what is the limit of, you know, where... You know, assuming that, you know, everything that we know is true, this is all stuff that is somewhat old, et cetera. But like, is there a limit to, you know, to the past behavior of somebody that completely invalidates them from being president? And if it's not this type of stuff, what is it?
We've already demonstrated that we're willing to move the line an awful lot, right? I mean, mm-hmm. like cocaine, sure, that's cool. DUI, yeah, we're down with it. You know, in some ways, I think it was inevitable that we were now going to test the limits of sexual behavior. I would have assumed we would have tested the atheist constraint next, but I guess we're going to have to wait till the next cycle for that one.
Yeah, and it's interesting that Trump actually, I mean, obviously had been pro-abortion pretty much in every instance up until he was running for president. Eli, what do you think? Is, you know, beyond anything else, you know, do we need to adjudicate these assault charges? And if they're real, does that mean he should never be elected president or anybody like him?
Well, I mean, they totally came out of the blue. I mean, who could have guessed that somebody who made his money off of the Miss Universe pageant and has called Rosie O'Donnell a pig and everything else like that would be such a misogynist? I mean, I just think that I kind of agree with Catherine here that it's testing the boundaries of like what is acceptable and decent behavior. And you can say the classic two coquet about Clinton. But I think that there is an important difference here, which is that in the cases of Clinton, it appears that that these women, I think maybe with the exception of Kathleen Willey, wanted, you know, were charmed by him. In the case of Trump, it appears that he's kind of a serial groper who, if he can't get you into bed by buying you furniture, we'll just start kissing you after taking some tic-tac.
But he did take no for an answer with the furniture. And let me also point out, if I may, Eli, that I don't think Juanita Broderick or Paula Jones were.
Yeah, fair enough.
You know I mean, those are assaults if they're true. But
let me resend that for.
One of the things that I did in thinking about this, and it's also weird, like, you know, I'm old enough where I remember the Clinton stuff. And actually, I mean, I started at Reason in 93. So, you know, this was all out there. And I remember it, whereas I realize a lot of people either, you know, forgot it or never knew about it. But, you know, when Gloria Steinem in 1998 wrote a piece in the New York Times magazine saying, you know, which is now called the One Free Grope policy, but where she said, look, you know, this is all kind of fucked up and weird and, you know, especially from a feminist point of view, but that as long as the person understood that yes meant yes and no meant no. And she was claiming somehow that Clinton actually, like he stopped with Kathleen Willey after she ran out of the room. So that meant that he understood no meant no. And with Trump, you know, in the furniture case, he tried, it didn't work, and that was, he moved on. So I don't know.
I actually think the no means no piece of it, though, if there's any fallout from this, aside from the actual result of the election, I think Rush Limbaugh's remarks on this really took me by surprise, actually, when he says, he said sort of shortly after all this stuff surfaced, you know, basically complaining that nowadays, you know, there's this magic word and it's the only thing that matters in American sexual mores today. It's just this one thing. Do you know what it is? It's consent. And he, this is like, to him, this is the core of the problem. Yeah. Is apparently we're cool with any kind of sex as long as it's consensual. And it's like, yeah, that's.
I know that my immigrant grandparents didn't come here so that I could have any kind of sex or even consensual sex.
I mean, to me, it's interesting because it also speaks to, I mean, not to kind of do the current political event reinforces my pre-existing views thing, but like, consent should be the relevant question about literally everything in the entire world if it were up to me. And the idea that conservatives are still litigating the question of whether or not consent is relevant in one-on-one sexual encounters is kind of blowing my mind.
And exclusively heterosexual ones, too. So it's not even, you know, we're not even getting into anything, you know, out of the plain vanilla package. Eli, what do you think about it? I mean, you're not a libertarian, but you're libertarian-ish for sure.
I like to consider myself libertarian curious.
Okay, lib curious. Very, very nice term. I hope that gets wide acceptance and use. It is kind of weird then that we're relitigating. I mean, this is what a lot of I think, you know, it started with feminism and then it moved into the general culture, and it was a good thing. This is, you know, we got rid of most of this, or certainly not, if not the behavior, the mentality that was like, you know, and you see this in every Clint Eastwood movie, at least through Bronco Billy, you know, where a woman, you know, he basically tries to kiss a woman or slaps her and then she falls into his arms. I mean, that was the way things were. Why, you know, do we really need to be relitigating the idea of consent in sexual activity in a presidential race?
Well, I would just say I think we're missing a little bit the forest for the trees. The tape is so damaging in part because it's undisputably Trump, so we can't deny it. But also, it's pathetic. We're talking about a C-rate celebrity, Billy Bush, and he feels the need that he has to brag to this guy about how he gropes people. It's disgusting. I mean, it's like I just find it to be – this is somebody who is supposedly sort of the fist – of the people against the establishment. And he's talking about the kind of behavior, and he even says it, you can get away with anything when you're a star, that most of us, that to me, that's such a chasm. And I realize his shtick from the very beginning has been, listen, I used to be one of these guys, and I'm telling you, I know how the system works, I'm the only one who can change it. And that's a powerful narrative. But when you put the whole thing together about exactly who he is and how he's led his life, the story is really about how this person is living on this very privileged stratosphere that most of us have no idea about. And I think if we think about it for, you know, with anything other than very partisan blinders on, it's, you know, it's kind of like, why aren't we just, you know, horrified by this guy? He has no humility, no empathy, and he's reduced to this kind of pathetic stuff. It's not locker room talk. It's just, it's awful.
I actually think that one of the things, you know, it falls in line with his anti-PC stuff, that he is willing to say things that normally would not be said is, I don't want to say it's persuasive in any way, but it's pretty bracing. And I thought watching the second debate, you know, in the first couple of statements he made, he seemed very restrained and subdued. And then after Hillary Clinton explained, you know, marched through the parade of horribles of how totally unfit he was for president. And then he went after her with Bill Clinton and whatnot. I thought that was pretty exciting to watch. I'm not sure it's a good thing. But let's talk about Hillary Clinton then and WikiLeaks and what's coming out about that. But also, to your point, Eli, Hillary is also somebody who lives in a completely different world. She doesn't drive. She doesn't, you know, she has people take care of everything. She gets off scot-free. Do you think, first Eli and then Catherine, is Hillary Clinton unfit to serve? Not whether or not she has relevant experience and everything, but has she done things that discredit her from being either a legitimate or an effective president?
I'll go first, I guess, in that I think that she is a kind of familiar awful, which is, we've seen this before. The stuff with the Clinton Foundation is clearly an example of sort of an unprecedented monetizing of Bill Clinton's ex-presidency. And that, I think, would be enough to make a credible case had she been running against someone who wasn't, you know, stratospherically awful. And I think that, you know, she doesn't have, in my view, any particularly interesting or new ideas about how to manage the government. She is a kind of typical statist. She doesn't represent very radical changes, and that she has a real problem with dissembling and not being honest when confronted about things that should be smaller scandals. Like, I'm one of the people who thinks that the email thing is not the end of the world. It's not really about classified information. But all of her answers about it were so bad and so dishonest that she made it worse than it should have been. Now, that is something that we've seen in American politics. We've seen in American presidents. Her husband had a lot of these same problems, although he was more charming, certainly, and a better kind of politician than she is. I think with Trump, though, we're talking about somebody who is so serially dishonest, is such a con man in his practice and how he got there, that it is something that's somewhat unprecedented. So it's always like the devil you know versus the devil you don't. But in the case of Hillary Clinton, it's a devil that we know. It's a bad devil. We don't like it. But I think it's, in this case, it's not even really a choice. You gotta, you know, I think Trump is just too dangerous. His character is too flawed.
Well, that, of course, was not the question. I wasn't asking you whether or not we should all vote for Hillary, and that we only have two choices, because we'll get to the third. We'll talk about Gary Johnson and Jill Stein. I know that Eli is really agonizing over whether or not to vote for Jill Stein. But, Catherine, with Hillary and WikiLeaks, is it a false equivalency to say, look, Trump, you know, this stuff from Trump's past is coming out and it disqualifies him? But, you know, Hillary has her own past that's coming out. And are you excited by the at least the promise of WikiLeaks, you know, releasing things that are damning to her, if not the reality of it?
You know, I am very rarely a woman of the people, but here I think I'm going to actually say, I think the framing of does it disqualify her or is she not fit to serve is kind of elitist garbage. I mean, the people get the president they choose, and we've chosen some humdingers over the years. I don't actually think Trump is so awful that he is in some special category of awful that requires us to subvert our own underlying principles should he win or anything like that. I, of course, would like everyone upon, you know, gazing upon the prospect of a Trump presidency, whether or not it happens, to say, golly gee, maybe we should roll back the purview of the executive. But he's totes awful, but not special awful, I don't think. And it's probably easier for me to say that at this moment when it looks like he's not going to win.
Right.
But I think that's where I come down. And I think, you know, the WikiLeaks stuff is a great example of everybody is awful, politicians doubly so, when you start digging around, which is a reminder that just because someone wears their awful on the surface like Trump does, doesn't mean we're necessarily talking about radically different kinds of people.
Hey, Kevin, what's the worst thing that we've learned from the WikiLeaks? I've gone through some of them myself, and I've been reading the stories. And what do you think?
I think it's total Hannah Arendt stuff. I think it's like all banality of evil. It's just it's none of it. There's no bomb in here, right? Like there's no aha moment that isn't just basically confirmation of what we already knew. But we didn't used to have access to this stuff. I mean, I do think there's a difference between a world where you can read these shitty emails and a world where you simply take it on faith that they exist.
I would agree with that, but I also don't. I mean, I would, with all due respect to Hannah Arendt, I think we're seeing, like, you know, you're right, it's banal. It's kind of more of the same. But, I mean, don't you think, like, today, Donald Trump gave the personal Facebook information of, like, one of his accusers? That's, like, horrible. I just can't. And there's a whole bunch of stuff like that. from his like tolerance of the alt right.
I don't disagree with any of that, but to also and maybe it is that particularly in essentially a two-party system where, you know, it's going to be either the Republican or the Democrat who wins. Trump is particularly awful. But for me, you, Eli, you had asked what's really bad about the WikiLeaks stuff. And for me, part of it was the assuming, and there's no reason not to believe that the transcripts and the kind of headers that her own staff did of summaries of the speeches she gave to various audiences, where she is totally bullshitting when she is saying, I'm against free trade, I'm a protectionist, which she's totally running on and which she was running on in 2008, when she talks about a lot of policies, you know, that she is now espousing, you know, she was espousing the complete opposite of that. And I don't, you know, the question isn't whether or not that rises to the level of Trumpian problems, but there's something really wrong with that. And for me, what I'm taking out of the WikiLeaks stuff is nothing about Hillary ultimately, but it's that all of us, but especially those in public office, are going to have to shape up because this stuff is going to come out one way or the other. And the best way to inoculate yourself against it is by being the same person in front of different audiences. People understand that you use different rhetoric in different situations, but it's one thing to, you know, kind of sugarcoat something versus, you know, castor oil it in another circumstance than to say, look, I agree with you 100%. On this policy, but you know, in my public life, I'm going to say I don't even know who you are. And the fact that Hillary refused to discuss these or bring them out herself, I find that deeply disturbing. If not, you know, it's not like a legal issue, but it shouldn't. I don't think it should be passed over and just say, well, you know, all politicians are pieces of shit. So you know, of course, what did you expect?
No, but they are, and we did. I mean, right, like. We knew in the last cycle that she had done this two-step on trade, for instance. She campaigned against NAFTA, and you know, her aides accidentally gave away the game at the time. And she subsequently voted in ways and supported bills that show that her position was different than the one she campaigned on. So I think like having the email, it's nice. It's good to have confirmation. Yeah. It's good to have more information. But I guess I'm not convinced that we didn't fundamentally know that and suspect her of that just by virtue of the fact that she was a politician.
And this,
and I just say, yeah, I think there's one like subtle difference here, which is that everybody in the Democratic Party who is really against free trade knows that Hillary Clinton is conning them. And they knew that before these WikiLeaks. And now they have the proof. And that's significant. But I'm just saying that everybody knew that. I'm worried, I get the sense that Trump supporters don't understand how much he's conning them.
Yeah.
And I, as somebody who's like a national security person, I'm very concerned that not just the government, but lots of people who are cybersecurity experts are saying that, you know, the Russians are behind this and you're only seeing these disclosures about Democrats. I mean, you know, if this was happening in a pre-digital era, then it's Watergate, right? I mean, it's like breaking into someone's office and stealing their files and then own for one party and disclosing them. I mean, that's you know, that is a kind of tampering in our elections that's very troubling to me. And then to see the party of Reagan, the party of cold warriors, to fucking laugh that off and be like, oh, whatever.
Well,
look at WikiLeaks. It's mind-blowing. It's mind-blowing.
Yeah, I agree. It's mind-blowing. But it's also, you know, worth asking, like, first off, is the information legitimate? Because part, you know, there was a weak gesture on the part of Democrats or Hillary partisans to say, oh, well, you know, we don't even know if this is true or not. But she hasn't denied any of it. So we assume, you know, and it's worth understanding, is this coming out because of some complicity with Russia? But on another level, it's kind of like, well, so what? You know, and like, does it mean you're saying, you know, people in the Democrats know they're being duped? Some of the WikiLeaks stuff that was talking about the way that the DNC was like working, you know, open or covertly to kneecap Bernie Sanders you know, and to change the outcome or, you know, questions coming from CNN, you know, getting, advance notice for Hillary Clinton. That's pretty serious stuff. And again,
serious stuff. The chairman of the political party, in part, is supposed to be interested and invested in nominating what they perceive. Now, maybe this is wrong, by the way. Maybe this is the year Bernie could have won. But that certainly in 2015 and early 2016, everybody thought there's no way. Yeah. And, you know, I'm going to say this, but I bet a lot of Republicans had wished Rentz Priebus was a little bit more like Debbie Wasserman Schultz.
Yeah, I agree.
Than Trump. I mean, I agree that I'm for disclosure, and I'm not saying it's not a story, but I just think that every progressive in the Democratic Party knows that Hillary Clinton's conning them, and she does it anyway. And it's like, yeah, this is it's banality. I think Catherine summed it up. With Trump, we're like, you know, hey, I mean, we're getting in very unprecedented territory there.
Well, you know, the one thing is I think in concert with Catherine, this is for me, it's less. It's not the language of moral outrage, really, Trump is a disgusting human being. He's a criminal human being. Hillary is the worst, you know, the biggest liar ever or anything. And it's just we're going to be living with these types of disclosures. And it does seem odd to me that states as well as politicians don't seem to understand that it's actually like they can change. You know, there are no bombshells to release if you actually just kind of live on the straight and narrow and are somewhat consistent in all of your statements and all of your positions, and you're not a serial groper or a serial liar. Which brings us to Gary Johnson, who the Libertarian Party candidate, who's around 9% now and is neither of those things, and has in a recent interview with me, he said, you know, that hypocrisy is the one thing that, is unforgivable. And he obviously is a novice politician, despite having run New Mexico for 8 years as a Republican governor. Eli, you had in a column that you wrote, you're at Bloomberg View, you had talked about how, like, you know, Gary Johnson is a pretty good guy, and you agree with him on a lot of stuff, not about foreign policy particularly, but that he, you know, that Americans are voting for a commander-in-chief, and he just does not fill that role. That was before he gaffed on Aleppo, and then compounded it by in an interview that was on Morning Joe. Then he went on Hardball and had another goof. Has Gary Johnson shrunk even still, or do you think he released a foreign policy talk or a speech and a kind of position last week at the University of Chicago? Has he filled out at all for you, or is he? You've still written him off.
Well, I don't. I 180 degrees disagree with him on. He comes back to that the problem is regime change, and I've been meaning to write something on this particular element, not just of Gary Johnson, but everybody now is against it. And I think that regime change is actually a very good idea. Military invasions is not a good idea, and we should separate those two concepts. And I wish that Gary Johnson. He keeps coming back to that line about regime change, which specifically rubs me the wrong way because there's so many regimes worthy of change, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. But that said, I think if Bill Weld was the top of the ticket as opposed to the co-ticket.
Please, we refer to them, Ed Reason, as the top and the bottom of the ticket.
Right. I mean, if someone like Bill Weld, who I think is it just kind of more of I think he's just better in that wholesale sense. And I'm not, this is just my own perception, would probably give these candidates who are so terrible a real run for their money. There's something about Gary Johnson's demeanor and maybe he's too authentic in some ways that I just think in some ways just disqualifies him from the modern presidency. I think that's maybe more of an indictment of us, but that was what I was trying to capture when I was writing on that.
And
that
so column. with somebody like Bill Weld, it's not so much policy difference as, you know, kind of style almost.
Well, Bill
and
Weld,
I don't mean that in a cheap way.
Responsible. Like if you think Trump University is bad, like he was involved in another private university, which actually, you know, was there were criminal issues with that. So, I mean, I think there's skeletons in his closet that would come out and we'd have to see if he was really under that fire. But I mean, I sort of am of the view that Dan Carlin's latest podcast said that he thinks if there was a more telegenic third party option that they would do very well, a Ross Perot or somebody like that. So I just think that it's like Gary Johnson, and I understand what happened. He was the most qualified person running on the Libertarian side. He's done it before. He got the nomination. But can you imagine if you had someone with a little bit more gravitas and name ID, I think that they would do very well this year.
Catherine, go ahead.
No, just there's also, though, this disease that I think intellectual conservatives in particular are subject to right now, which is like, gee, I wish I didn't have to vote for Trump. And, you know, the Libertarian Party has unexpectedly disappointed me by not being conservative. And I think it's like, it's a little bit disingenuous. And, you know, we've seen this from National Review. We've seen this from The Federalist. Everybody did this same article about a month ago where they said, if only Gary Johnson was pro-life, if only Gary Johnson knew more about foreign policy, if only Gary Johnson was secretly an actual conservative, like maybe Bill Weld is, on a lot of issues, then I could vote for him. And it's like, yeah, if he was a charismatic conservative with great credentials to be president, maybe he could have won the Republican nomination too. Like,
yeah,
it's a counterfactual that on some level stops making sense.
And it's kind of deeply dishonest is too strong a term, but deeply delusional, right?
And the idea of saying essentially like, gee, why can't the libertarians field a more serious person when your candidate is Donald freaking Trump? Yeah. I'm struggling here to keep a straight face.
Yeah,
about
and
it.
Let's, you know, also, I mean, one of the things that is odd is that now that the Libertarian Party has somebody who is, you know, on the verge and in some polls is in double digits, somehow he's not doing enough because he's not leading the race. Whereas, you know, nobody before him, when Ron Paul ran in 1988, he wasn't polling 9% or 10% in polls. So that is kind of strange, you know, to constantly be showing, you know, saying Gary hasn't done enough. Like he's somehow a disappointment.
Gary Johnson's doing that without the benefit of a loyal newsletter readership. So
yes. Well, Eli, what do you think are we witnessing? And what, let's talk about Russia real quickly, because it's come up.
You know,
several
you don't want to talk about Jill Palestine.
Okay. Well, yes, that's
kidding,
yeah.
Kidding.
Well,
you're
you know, the one thing I'll say about Jill Stein is that she is, I mean, like Trump, in a way, you know, she has never really stood for an elective office that she could win. She's never been in one. And that kind of bothers me on some level. I think that any candidate who is on enough ballots in order to win theoretically 270 electoral votes should be on the debate stage, no question about it. But she is not a serious candidate in the way that I think Gary Johnson is.
Correct.
But what about Russia? Because that's come up, you know, it comes up in the WikiLeaks. Putin is Putin objectively pro Donald Trump? It's not like Hillary Clinton wasn't sitting there pushing reset buttons with Russians and obviously failing at that. Is foreign policy a serious it's a bad thing to say, is it a serious concern? But how much should foreign policy be guiding our decision making in this election? And if it is, what do we have? I mean, we've got Donald Trump on the one hand, and then we've got Hillary Clinton, who's one of the most god awful secretaries of state in U.S. history. How do you choose?
John Kerry is a level or two worse than Hillary Clinton, if you can imagine.
Well, you've written recently about Russia and treating Russia as a pariah. What does that mean, and what is the implication? I mean, does that get us anywhere? Because Johnson, for instance, has said, look, the only way out of Syria is through a diplomatic resolution. To get the U.S. out of Syria is through a diplomatic resolution that's going to involve Russia very deeply. Is that... You know, is that just wrong because you don't want that to be true, or is it just wrong because it doesn't have to be true?
Well, it's wrong because the Russians are exacerbating the terrorism problem by saturation bombing of civilians. It's wrong for the same reasons that it was, you know, it's wrong because Russian policy and keeping Assad in power will prolong this conflict and exacerbating the problem of terrorism. It's wrong because, you know, it's basically Russia is taking the same strategy as Iran and Assad, which is to create a choice that you can only be with, you know, the dictator you know, who's starving and killing you and bombing you from the air and dropping chemical weapons on you, or you can be with ISIS, which will behead you and, you know, force your
isn't Gary Johnson the only person in this who's also saying, hey, you know what, I seem to remember that the United States was occupying the country next to Syria for, you know, a dozen plus years, and that that has something to do with this. And whatever you want to say about this particular instance in this particular time, if we don't rethink our foreign policy, it's just going to be this endless loop that we've certainly had in the 21st century, where we keep getting into problems. And then the only solution is to continue doing what we're doing, which started the cycle in the first place.
Well, I respectfully disagree with that viewpoint, and I don't think he's the only person who's brought that up. Donald Trump has sounded that before, and there was an iteration of Hillary Clinton in 2008 who liked to sort of say that kind of thing as well, even though it was before the Syria crisis. And I just think that it's not about whether – at this point, I think that if you do not take the line that Assad has to go, and thinking about ways in which – so that he does go – and one of those things is really on Obama by keeping the Russians, or in a more muscular way, out of the country, then I think you're only going to have a conflict that will continue on. He's gone too far. The other thing is, if you care about the international system and you care about certain sort of standards that people who use chemical weapons should face horrible consequences, if that's something that matters, which, you know, there was a time when it mattered to both the right and the left, then you have to look at Syria and you have to sort of say, all right, well, what do we do? That does not mean that I think we should send 200,000 Americans there, but there is a kind of combination of airstrikes, special operations, creating sort of safe zones that is not the same as a coalition provisional authority and deciding to rebuild a country from scratch, which I think I agree at this point is not what we ought to do. But I think that Gary Johnson suffers from the same problem that Donald Trump and Barack Obama suffer from, which is that they can only see an all or a nothing. And oftentimes, our involvement in this in the world is usually sort of shades of gray in this regard. And, you know, so on Gary Johnson, who's not going to be the president, I would just sort of disagree with him on that. But I agree with your original point about Hillary Clinton. Yes, she did the reset after there was plenty of evidence that Russia, in my view, should not be integrated into the international community if they continue to undermine it. And what I thought was extraordinary was that people like Michael McFaul, who were the real policy architects of that, told me that they now say that this clearly did not work. And if you don't push back on a country like Russia, then you're only inviting for them to continue to act in a more roguish manner. Yeah. And
Catherine, what do you think about that? Is it imperative for America to maintain international order in a way that is more consistent with, you know, essentially the Cold War or the early post Cold War?
You know, I'm a typical boorish American, so I look at this at least the aspect of it that seems more pressing or urgent to me is the different approaches toward Putin himself and what it says about the candidates between Clinton and Trump. And, you know, I agree, you know, Eli's general description of, you know, there's a point where Clinton's pragmatism kind of slides into cowardice or bad judgment, depending on your point of view. I think there's something to be said for that. At the same time, we've got Trump out there saying of Putin, you know, he's very much a leader. He has strong control over his country. And, you know, when Clinton's response to that is to slam Trump as being unpatriotic because he likes Putin better than Obama, you know, that's the wrong tack, too. But it is to have someone who could potentially be president who identifies with that behavior on the part of Putin rather than just kind of giving into it on a pragmatic and semi-arbitrary basis strikes me as more alarming. You know, I think there's still kind of there's the not great scenario of the kind of appeasement approach that Clinton has taken, but there's the potentially worse scenario of like basically the U.S. president and Putin broing out somewhere.
I agree with all of that, Catherine, but I just dissent on one point, which is that I think that Hillary's red baiting in this campaign has been one of her high marks, and I think it's horrible.
No.
Because it's disgusting.
No, actually, that's not true. I mean, that particular point where she accuses Trump of being unpatriotic for saying nice things about Putin and saying bad things about Obama, like, I think it's horrific. And Jacob Sullivan pointed this out in our pages, that if we're actually defining patriotism as not criticizing the American president, we're in terrible condition.
And
I agree with you and Jacob on that. But the Trump giving these glowing reviews of Putin, when this is somebody who is invading his neighbors and destroying his own country, you know, and opposition, and at that moment, sort of, is to me, it's so unbelievable. And to hear these other idiots like Newt Gingrich go along with it, it's just, it's,
well,
I don't know.
Can I ask, and as a final point, I guess, because, you know, part of, I think, what we're all dealing with here, or this is my pet theory, is that, you know, we're still kind of stuck in the 20th century, and nobody has updated the calendars yet. And part of the problem is that the major institutions in American society inspire less and less confidence, less and less trust. So that, you know, okay, so Assad uses chemical weapons against innocent people, or against anybody, that's a bad thing. But then we went into Iraq on the basis of weapons of mass destruction, which never materialized in the way that we were told. So everybody is kind of like, yeah, I don't trust anything the government is saying. I don't trust anything WikiLeaks is saying. I don't trust anything anybody is saying, which in a way, I think Trump is kind of the ultimate triumph of that, where he, you know, at the beginning of the second debate, when he was trying to put down Hillary Clinton and say, you know, it's just words for her. It's just words. Like, she just says things. But he's the ultimate example of that, where if he says it's true, and we're kind of in a post-fact world because nobody believes anything, especially coming out of the government. But where do we go to, forget about the Russian reset. Don't we need a reset with our government? What is our foreign policy? Has anybody articulated a foreign policy and built a consensus towards it, which means it would be harder to do? I mean, George H.W. Bush in the first Gulf War, which I think was a mistake, but because he built a broad alliance, that meant that, okay, well, you couldn't take out Saddam Hussein because the various people he allied with, in order to get an overwhelming force to commit to it, was that we're just going to pull him out of Kuwait. And then we're gonna pen him in. Do we need, you know, where are the thinkers, or where are they going to come from in a world where we have a president who's probably going to win with about 45% of the vote? And I guess, this is it's kind of a rambling note, Eli, but what, you know, the international order, it's like, what international order? Doesn't the United States have to realize that it's not 1989 or 1990 or 1945? And we're going to live in a world where Russia is going to have a good degree of dominance in certain spheres, and we're not going to be able to actually pin them in any more than we can pin China in the way that we might have 30 or 40 years ago.
Well, I'm not calling on the U.S. to, force the Russian government to accept some sort of climate change agreement, or I'm not even saying that the U.S. can do all that much to make the country more democratic. But when you have a when Russia invades Ukraine, that violates a post-Cold War agreement known as the Budapest Memorandum, Right. Then that sets the stage. If they don't pay a price for that, for further aggression down the road. And I'm just saying, you can pay now or you can pay later. But at a certain point, there will be some limit where I think even you, Nick, will say, okay, this is no longer their sphere of influence. Now they're just, you know, kind of going for it. So my view is always that we have to assess that right now that Russia under Putin is just an aggressive rogue state, and that we have to focus on containing them. Mm-hmm. And that served us well in the Cold War, and it should serve us well now. And I would say, as for China, it's the similar kind of thing. When they test the boundaries of free navigation in the South China Sea, we're not asserting that America says, you know, who gets to sail in the South China Sea, and only America. We're not asking the Chinese to change their, you know, two-child policy or anything like that. We're talking about something that has been a staple of U.S. foreign policy for over a century, which is that we should have the free navigation of waters all
Although
over the world.
That is also not what has underwritten American foreign policy in the 21st century, which has been, we're going to go into Afghanistan, and we're not just going to depose a bad regime. We're going to rebuild the country and make it better than it ever was. And the same thing in Iraq, and then in Libya, You know why? Because based on this, there's no reason.
Well, Libya, we didn't do
nation building, but there's no cause for us. Catherine, what do you think? I mean, as you look forward to the 21st century, hopefully, which will be starting any year now, you know, are Americans ready? And I guess this is partly consistent with some of the things you were saying, like, you know, are we ready to live in an America that's not reduced, but, you know, the world has changed. And just like, you know, there aren't three broadcast channels anymore. There aren't three world powers or one world power. We're going to live in a world where America is ultimately less able to dictate the terms of anything in the world.
Yeah, I mean, I am always tempted to the narrative that power is devolving to the people thanks to, you know, technology and Pop-Tarts and stuff. But I do think, you know, when I listen to Eli describe the appropriate U.S. foreign policy, it's so subtle. It's so sophisticated. It's the wielding of a scalpel in capable hands. And then I look at these idiots who are going to have to do it.
John Kerry.
And it's like, it's a billy club at best, you know? And I just, that's where I always wind up. That's my admittedly cowardly libertarian position is, the government is bad at the things it tries to do. It will be bad at this. It has been bad at this. And to predicate a philosophy on some level of competence strikes me as foolhardy.
But you're not nihilistic, right?
Yeah. That was wonderful.
But you're not nihilistic. It doesn't, I mean, you still have to act,
No, but
right?
I think my optimism springs entirely from the extent to which U.S. foreign policy doesn't matter rather than that it is good.
Yeah.
No, it matters.
Well, we will leave it there. It's that either the world is getting better despite American foreign policy, or it would get better faster with good or effective foreign policy. I want to thank Catherine Mangu Ward, the editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine, and Eli Lake of Bloomberg View. He's a national security and national defense writer there. Thanks, both of you. If you enjoy this podcast, please subscribe, rate and review it, and subscribe at iTunes, and the world will be a better place. Thanks so much. For Reason, I'm Nick Gillespie.